Take it off.
Okay, I did that. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are on Daf Lamed Amud Bet 30B, in English 30B4. 30B4. Remember that we have arrived now at the subject of Kibud Av V'Em, of honor thy father and thy mother. And last week we read some material about the basics, the fact that one is required to honor father and mother, that there were two mitzvot. One was to revere the parent, revere thy mother and thy father, and honor thy father and thy mother. Okay, those are two different mitzvot. We don't yet know, we haven't examined what the differences are and what practically the meaning of honor or revere actually is from a machlokes perspective. We will come to that. But the last thing that we saw was that God is very concerned about the honoring of parents. And that he says, when you honor your parents, you honor me. Okay? And then the next thing that we learned was that, in fact, the reason for that is that every person is the product of three people: the mother, the father, and God. People, in the figurative sense. That's where we are now on a second statement that reaffirms that theme. On the right side of the page in the middle, it says, Tanu Rabbanan. The rabbis taught, now this is a baraita, Shlosha shutafin hem ba'adam. There are three partners for every person. Akadosh Baruch Hu va'avi v'imo. The Holy One, blessed be He, and His father and His mother. Bizman she'adam mechabed et avi v'et imo. When a person honors his father and his mother, Amar Akadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be He, says, Ma'ale ani aleihem. I consider it ke'ilu darti b'nehem v'kibduni, as if I had dwelt in their midst and they had honored me. Because, naturally, God does dwell in a person's midst, because a person is a product also of God. Everyone has that side to him as well. So this is a very basic conception, which we talked a little bit about last time, that there are really three partners to the creation of every human being: father, mother, and the Holy One, blessed be He. And the note here is a good note. It brings the Gemara from Sota, which notes the famous Hebrew combination of words, Ish and Isha. Ish is a man, Aleph Yud Shin. Isha is a woman. Those two words have two letters in common, and each has one letter different. The two letters in common are the Aleph and the Shin. Put the Aleph and the Shin together, Ish, which is fire. So that essentially every human being, a man and a woman, are brought together by their fire, their passion. And if you bring the man and a woman together in the right way, then you take the separate letters, which in the man is a yud, and in the woman is a hey, and you bring them together. Yud and a hey together spells Yah, which is like in hallelujah. Okay, it's the Lord. So that is the concept here, and it's embodied in the language, that it is the combination of man and woman, of husband and wife, that bring together the normal passions of existence together with the presence of God. And that is the basis of the Jewish marriage, Jewish wedding ceremony, and of our concept of what is special about every child as well. Okay? Questions? We're good. Okay. Now, we have learned that there are two obligations. There are two mitzvot as far as parents go. Kabed et avicha v'et imecha. Honor your father and your mother. Ve'ish imo v'aviv tirau. Every person shall revere his mother and father. Okay? So keep that in mind.
You know, I don't understand this.
What?
Why? It seems to me, honor your father and then every man, it seems to me it's redundant. They're repeating.
No, they're not repeating for two reasons. One reason is because once it says honor, and the other time it says revere. And those are two different words, and they're two different ideas. Okay? That's number one. Number two, in both those verses, the verses are constructed differently. It says, honor your father and your mother. It says, revere your mother and your father. So there are really two differences between the verses. One is revere and honor, and the other is the order of mother and father in the verses. Okay? Tanya, Rabbi Omer, the Braita says, Rabbi Judah the Prince says, Galui v'yadua lifnei misha marva ya'olam. It is revealed and known to the one who spoke, and the world came into being. Sheben mechabed et imo yoter mi'aviv. That a son honors his mother more than his father. Okay, and then the opposite of, well, then it explains a little bit. Mipnei shemishadlato bidvarim. Because a mother, how do we say that, wins him over with pleasant words. In other words, there's a unique relationship, which is opposite sex. The mother has a unique relationship with the son. And the opposite is the father has a special relationship with the daughter. Okay? And most of us who have sons and daughters kind of testify that this is, of course, true. Or if you have one or the other, you can tell us the extent to which it's true. Okay? Lefichach, HaKadosh, Lehigdin HaKadosh Baruch Hu Kibud Av LeKibud Em. Therefore, the Holy One, blessed be He, put the honor of the father before the mother. Why? Again, remember, it is more natural for the son to honor the mother. Therefore, when speaking of honor, the Torah says, honor your father and your mother. Mother, he's going to honor. But the father, you have to emphasize. Father, you have to emphasize, okay? V'galui v'yadu lifnei mishama v'haya olam. And it is known and appreciated before he who spoke and the world came into being. In other words, God understands. Sha'ben mityare mi'aviv yoter me'imo. That a son is more fearful of his father than his mother. Mibnei shemilamdo Torah. Here gives a reason, that is because his father teaches him the Torah. Lefichach higdim HaKadosh Baruch Hu mora ha'em. Therefore, the Holy One, blessed be He, put the reverence, the fear of the mother before that of the father. So when it says, you shall fear the parent, you shall, I keep translating it as revere the parent, it mentions the mother before the father. The assumption being that fear of the father is the more natural thing, and therefore the Torah has to command the fear of the mother. Okay? So it's an interesting balance then. We now see a reason why, first of all, the two different words are at least two different emotions. They reflect two different types of parental relationships. And the order, therefore, of the father and the mother is different in both of them in order to urge that which is less natural, in fact.
These are directed just at men.
Correct. And it would be the opposite for the women. But the assumption is it's the opposite for the women. The Torah will only talk of it in this language, but it's the assumption is the opposite for the women.
Okay. But it's never okay? mentioned for women.
Yeah. It's not, here it's not mentioned. Correct. Here the only discussion is in terms of the son. But remember what we learned, though. You must remember that the basic principle of this whole part of the Mishnah is that what is incumbent upon the child is equally incumbent on male and female. Right? That was the basic principle of the Mishnah. The Mishnah, first of all, had mitzvot toward of the father toward the child, where it said son father toward the son. There we learned it's a mitzvah of the father to the son, and it is gender specific. The Mishnah learned the opposite when we're talking about the mitzvah of the child to the to the parent. And it is non-gender specific, both in terms of the child and in terms of the parent. Okay, so you have to, that's what we studied before. We read that already. We read in the Mishnah, and then we read it last week. That was the beginning of this discussion last week. Okay, so you have to understand that to begin with. So we're in a piece of Talmud now where everything is gender neutral, as it were, except where. You see, it's not entirely gender neutral because it is assumed that there are differences in emotional relationships. And therefore, you have to do a mutatis mutandis kind of argument here as well. Okay?
I may not have understood what you said because the reference, you said that the reference to revere says mother first.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
It says here, it is said, you shall revere your father and your mother.
That's if it. That's what it says. It's an incorrect translation. Where is it? Where does it say
it's,
that?
It's the last paragraph on 30b4.
30b4. Ish imo v'aviv. Every man you shall revere. It says, mine you shall revere your mother and your father.
It says here, it is said, every man you shall revere your
column.
Father and your mother.
In the left-hand column. No,
the
left-hand.
Last paragraph is the left-hand.
We're reading in the right-hand side. We're on the right-hand side. The previous one is not translated correctly. The Hebrew says one thing and the English says the other. They get it right finally. They get it right finally on the right side of the page when they're in fact dealing with this material and the fact that one precedes the other because it's material to the argument. Okay? But in the others, they appear not to have gotten it correctly in the English.
Now, the word revere, you refer to it as fear.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't there a more noble, honorable definition?
Well, practically speaking, I don't want to really say because practically each of these words is going to be fleshed out very practically. Okay? So we'll see exactly what it means. So in English, there's no... The Hebrew word, the reason that I keep doing that is because the Hebrew word lira, yare, can really mean a variety of things. It does mean fear, and there is an aspect of that. It does mean revere, and there is an aspect of that. But I don't want to go too far with any of those things because it's not relevant. The English translation is insignificant. The fact is that each of these terms will be defined very specifically.
Okay. Doesn't it sound right that these guys would make an incorrect translation as simple as that?
If you look at the bottom on the left hand side, read the Hebrew. Ish imo v'aviv tirao. Right? It's easy to translate that. A person should revere his mother and his father. And the translation says father and mother.
Wife, that doesn't seem like they'd make a mistake like that.
Go ask Nussan Sherman. Send him a letter. Okay.
Tell
Nussan Sherman. Nussan Sherman, who makes no mistakes, how could he have done it?
Okay. Has to do with his mother and father.
I don't. You could give him analysis for what less.
It's a very simple thing.
Correct. Can't tell you. Okay. Let's keep going. Okay. We go on. Tana kame de Rav Nachman. A Tana taught before Rav Nachman. Bizman sha'adam mitza'er et aviv imo. When a person causes pain to his father and his mother. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, says the Holy One, blessed be He, Yafeh asiti shelo darti b'nehem. I did wisely when I decided not to dwell in their midst. In other words, God says every once in a while, I understand why I have to get out of the house. Why I have to separate myself from the people. Why? Why God says this, right? She'il mele darti b'nehem tziaruni. Because if I dwelt with them, they would have given me pain too. In other words, I would have watched them, I would have been there watching them pain their parents. And if you pain your parent, you pain God at the same time. Okay? You see again and again here the use of parent and God. That there is clearly an analogy between the two. That the relation to the parent is a relation that is similar to the relation with God.
There's a catch 22 here, because if God had dwelt between them, then there wouldn't have been any grievance.
Not this God.
No?
This God tried to dwell with them, and you know what they did?
They threw him out.
That's what the Torah, I mean, I'm not making that up, that's what the Torah says.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm. You heard about a stiff-necked people? It wasn't the other people, it was this one. Okay. We're a tough group. Very tough group. Okay. Ilma ledarti b'nehem siyaruni. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, said Rabbi Isaac, kol ha'over avera b'seter, everyone who transgresses something in secret, ki'ilu dochek ragle shechina, it is as if he pushes the feet of the Shekhinah, of God's presence. Now, dochek ragle Shekhinah means pushes him away. Pushes him away. Now, this is from a verse, Shenemar ko amar Hashem ha-shamayim kisi, says the Lord, the heavens are my seat, my throne. Va'aretz hadom raglai, and the earth is my footstool. The earth is my footstool. Okay? So in other words, if when we push God away, we push away his feet, right? He's not with us anymore. Because we think that God is not around. You know, we think that God is not present. Well, God's feet are in every place, as it were. And it's very anthropomorphic language, of course, but that's how the Talmud is. Amar Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, asur li adam shi'alech arba amot bekoma zekufa. And this is one of the results of that. If God is everywhere, and one should sense God's presence in every single place, then Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi says, it is forbidden for a person to walk 4 yards, 4 amot, bekoma zekufa, with an erect stature, because one should always realize God's presence, and one should bow in God's presence. One should feel a humility of the divine presence that is everywhere. Sheneamar melo chol haaretz kvodo, the whole world is filled with His glory. So God is everywhere, and our demeanor should reflect the ever-presence of God. I'm going to go a little bit further and then say a few words about that. Rav Huna bereda Rav Yehoshua, Rav Huna, the son of Rav Yehoshua, lo maske arba amot begilui arosh, did not even go 4 amot with his head uncovered. Amar, he said, shechina lemala miroshi, the divine presence is above my head. Now this is the what is sometimes referred to as the source for the head covering that a Jewish male customarily covers the head. And the head covering is there because of the divine presence. The divine presence is symbolized, I can tell you when I remember once when I was in rabbinical school, somebody for whatever reason appeared in class without a kippah. And the Talmud professor, I remember his words, he said, Mr. So-and-so, where is your yiras shamayim? Where is your fear of heaven? Now, of course, you can't see a person's fear of heaven, but yiras shamayim was his kippah. It was the wearing of the head. The presence of the kippah the wearing, the covering of the head, is symbolic of the sense of divine presence. I remember when we were in rabbinical school, we had a teacher who was a wonderful Talmudist, a great Talmudist from Bar Ilan University, who was grown up in Israel in the Ponivitch Yeshiva in Bnei Brak. Fantastic Talmudist, just wonderful, and a gorgeous Jew. I mean, just a beautiful Jew. And there was one funny thing about him, though, and that was that he always walked bent over. And we were studying this material, and we realized one day that this is why he was bent over, that it was the custom in Ponivitch, in the yeshiva, never to stand straight. It's not, their mothers were not American mothers. Sit up straight, stand up straight. They rather were seeking something else. And that was that even the carriage of the human frame, would in effect express the sense of divine presence. So the wearing of the covering on the head is yet another example of that. And that's the far more common one. I don't know whether it's so healthy to bend over, somewhat. But it's surely not a problem for the health. And this depends on where you live. If you cover your head, the wearing of a head covering. I had recently, I told some of you this experience that I had in Kyoto. We were in Kyoto a year ago in November, and I had some friends who wanted me to meet a Japanese Zen master.
What?
A Zen master, Zen Buddhism. A Zen Buddhist, and their rabbis are called masters, as it were. So we were taken to a monastery, one of the great, beautiful monasteries of Kyoto, Dayatoji, I think it was called, and we met the Zen master, and their particular religion, the activity that you engage in, the religious activity, is the making of tea. It's an unusual religion. The tea ceremony is the principal religious ceremony that they have. So we came into the monastery and sat down, as it were. You don't really sit. You sit on your haunches, nearly collapsed. Can hardly walk for days.
You keep your bed, that's good.
It wasn't permissible for you to be in the Buddhist temple.
Well, I can tell you there were no images whatsoever. The Zen Buddhists will not have images. Zen Buddhists. In the other Japanese temples, there are plenty of them. How can I tell you that? I'll tell you another time. But but in the Zen, there are no images at all. Because it's against they have a very imageless type of religious experience. So we come and we sit down there. And there's a Japanese acquaintance. And he's translating for the Zen master. So the master looks at me, and it was the end of November, so it was kind of cold, but I wear a hat, and then I took my hat off, and underneath the hat is the kippah. So the master looks over, and he says something in Japanese, and he says to him, to the Japanese with us, he says, what is on that man's head? So he asks me, and I explain. I explain Yirat Shamayim, that a Jew who is a religious Jew covers the head as a sign of the divine presence. And I said, everywhere, God is everywhere. God is here in this place. God is where I normally live. And for us, it is important to remember that everywhere that we go, we never are outside of the presence of God. So there's silence. Silence. And the Zen master then looks at me and he says, Japanese, he says something. And then the translator says, there are many routes up Mount Fuji, but they all go to the top. You understand that? It's a Zen statement. There are many routes up Mount Fuji, but they all go to the top. I thought that was an incredibly insightful and wonderful thing to say. It's just he understood exactly what I was talking about. And it was the way of saying, look, we understand each other. I make tea, you wear what you wear, but we're all in this together. It was just an extraordinarily insightful and beautiful way to put it.
I wonder if the converse is true, that if you don't wear a cap, okay, you're expressing irrelevance to God.
Or irreverence.
Irreverence, sorry.
Far be it for me to say. I think that certainly I've been swindled by people who cover their heads. And I've seen beautiful, gorgeous, religious human beings who do not. So obviously the issue is not a simple one. I would only say...
To Mount Fuji.
many paths up Mount Fuji. But I think that the point here is, though, that there is a certain traditional form for that. There's a traditional form for that, and head covering is that form. Certainly, I have no sense that the kippah, for example, is that form. I am sure in the time of the Talmud they didn't wear kippot. They wore head coverings. You know, we remarked yesterday at the inauguration, the only person wearing a decent hat was Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter.
Bush Senior.
Oh, Bush Senior also
had
one?
He had a fur thing.
Oh, no, but Jimmy Carter had a regular hat. He had a normal person's hat.
He had a chapeau.
He had a Jimmy Carter had a regular hat on.
Ted Kennedy
had. Well, Ted Kennedy was not up there. I'm just talking about the people who are right there. But I look at this, I said, finally a man has a decent sense of how to dress.
Finally, you say good about Jimmy.
So I say, who is this person? I look, is it Jimmy Carter? There you go, Jimmy Carter.
Looked like Scalia was wearing something like a kippah.
Is that right?
Around
the maybe a ski hat.
Maybe, no, I don't know.
It was,
I can't.
It was,
but all I'm just the point I was just getting to is that if you remember back, those of you who go back a while. The dress for the inauguration required the wearing of a hat.
A top
required.
Hat.
Required. Sure. John Kennedy was there in a top hat.
He did it in.
Right.
He destroyed the American hat industry. Single-handedly.
He didn't wear a hat. on the pulpit?
Not only there, but he never wore a hat at all.
Well, I remember that he didn't wear it afterwards, but he didn't wear it also on the pulpit?
He didn't.
No. He didn't wear a hat. That was the issue.
So, yeah. But everybody else did. The formal dress, you know, always involves such things, probably throughout history. It's not at all unusual. And here it is. I think that's what we're seeing reflected here as well, is a certain sense of propriety. And propriety has always been involved coverings and a variety of coverings of the different parts of the body.
So then... If it's not a kippah, though, doesn't this imply, though, that it's in the Talmud that they were covering their heads and not necessarily before? That it's a Talmudic? I mean, from the way you described
mm-hmm. it. Well, you know the...
Here, so does that mean that people covered their heads before?
The answer is we don't know. We don't have literary evidence. The joke goes that how do you know that you're supposed to cover the head? Because it says, and Abraham went out. How could he have gone out without a yarmulke? Okay. Okay, so that's the kind of hard-nosed logic that proves the Yarmulke goes back to Avraham Avinu. We don't have any. We have no sources for that. So this is. Well, it's not the only one, but this is among your early sources.
But we don't know what they were putting on their heads.
No.
It could have been a turban.
But that's what I'm saying. That's my point, is that it probably was the kippah as a modern thing. And by the way, the kippah is going out of style.
Really? What's coming in?
The black hat. If you have not seen what's going on in the Jewish community, I just spoke with somebody today who has children in Baltimore. And they said, if you go to the kosher supermarket in Baltimore, and 80% of the people wear black hats.
And the rest as well? Or just
no, not necessarily. That there's more variety in. But in the Orthodox community today, it's...
Is that the top hat that they wear? The black
not,
hat?
Not a top hat, but it's a black hat.
It's a black hat.
It's a fedora that's a black hat. But that, interestingly enough... In the last few years, it used to be that there was a combination of things, but I see more black hats today than I... In Israel, the wearing of the kippah in public is really only... it's the modern Orthodox. It's modern Orthodox who wear it, and not the ultra-Orthodox. Ultra-Orthodox don't wear a kippah in public anymore. You wear some, you'll see it, but more often than not, you will see the hat on the head.
Why do you think it is that the Pope wears the hat and everybody else takes their hats off?
Because I figured that out once. You know where I figured it out? You'll forgive me, please, sure. But I'm a conservative rabbi. At High Mass in St. Peter's, I went one Sunday morning to St. Peter's in Rome. I wanted to see what they do. So I went to the Mass to see how they conduct themselves.
It was an educational effort.
Of course, as all of these things are, including the Buddhist monastery. So I went to see what they do. I knew exactly what they did because they followed the Torah. They followed the Torah because they used all of the elements that were in the book of Leviticus. It was a sacrifice. And it was an order of sacrifice that they had. And in the book of Leviticus, no priest can officiate without a head covering. So obviously, they are actually, in their own way, they have a right that comes from the Torah, including the dress. The wearing of the vestments, the breastplate, they do all of that. We don't do that. They do it because they feel that they have taken over the temple service.
And the incense and the
swimming. The incense, all of it. It's all there. If you want to see it done, you have to go to either the Catholics or the Episcopalians. Episcopalians also do it.
One more question about the hat before we leave it, because it just seems like a fascinating attempt to sort of visualize the progression. And one would think that a hat was originally put on the head to be warm. But maybe not, because what you're pointing out...
No, it wasn't.
Different hats, and it's fashionable.
Dress is all symbolic. Dress is all symbolic. Mm-hmm. It has some practical sides to it, but it's at least 60% symbolic, I'm sure. Barry has been waiting, I'm sorry.
I'm reminded of the Tower of Babel. The image of the erect person is mm-hmm. almost
very
the
nice.
Image of mm-hmm. Challenging mm-hmm. ascendancy into places where humans don't belong.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if the hat isn't a capitulation in recognition that there is that limit.
Exactly. There's something above me, and I note it by putting something right there to symbolize what's above me.
It says, I'm not going
there. I'm not going.
You're slouching.
Yep.
But it harkens back to the
yep.
Tower of Babel.
I think it's all correct. That's all in the imagery.
So yeah. Does the hat allow you to stand up tall? Where it covers
no.
Your
head? Bobby, you want
to ask? I was going to say, when you're talking about the hats and everything, I just was at the Museum of Natural History a couple of hours ago, and you know, cultures and the headgear, which is not for anything other than status, display, you know, differentiation, all kinds of things. You see that in all these different cultures, they get elaborate with feathers. And so, and particularly men. So men and their headgear, Africa in particular, it's all part of this kind of symbolism, you know, symbolic reference of the clothing giving you a sense of the symbolism of the position.
Exactly.
Vis-a-vis people and God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when you went to see that Zen master, did you have to take your shoes off?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. You couldn't cross the threshold with your shoes on.
Even in a home, you take your shoes off.
You have to always take your shoes off.
You have tatami floors.
You have to always take
the
your shoes off.
Floors.
I learned that early on.
You know, I went into a Japanese tenant's apartment, and I had to take my shoes off at the doorstep.
Well, you did right. You did right. It's a very intelligent custom. I mean, why we don't do that, I don't know, because they know how to live.
Just as an aside, in a Japanese school, when you come into the building, there are racks.
Oh, there are racks, correct.
For the shoes. For individual pairs of shoes.
Correct.
For everyone.
Correct. The Japanese are fastidious about their cleanliness. It's just an amazing thing to see how clean they are. You really learn a great deal from them about cleanliness. And they would never think of going into a house with the dirt of the outside on it. It's just it's a sign of the barbarity of the West, mm-hmm, that we do things like that. They consider us barbarians.
I'm still questioning the propriety, okay, of putting on a hat to display the fear of God. Isn't it more important what's going on in you internally than what you wear on the outside?
No, not in most religions. Nearly every religion expects a person to show externally some signs of the internal. On the one hand, and to go beyond that, religion is a social experience. Religion is very much social. It is only partly personal, but it is very much social. And what religions do is that they create certain social standards and practices where the community participates in an idea. And clothing very much affects that, and clothing conveys communal ideas of what is appropriate, and what is appropriate has to do with a lot of symbolism.
The four amos,
mm-hmm,
I'm fascinated with that.
This is an ama from here to here.
Right.
Okay. It's probably a little bigger than that, so I have short arms, but it's roughly 30 some odd inches.
Right. But the footnote says that as a rule, the place that a person occupies consists to reach four amos in every direction from where,
mm-hmm,
he stands.
Correct.
So that notion of having some sort of field around the person,
mm-hmm,
is quite interesting.
Yes, there is that notion.
An emanation, correct, from the person.
Personal space, I think.
Yeah, it's personal space. There is a sense here. Of course, personal space does involve a certain sense, almost of emanation. I don't know that it's a scientific category, but it is the sense that the person is there. You don't have to touch them to be in their space. There's a certain closeness where you would invade their space, which means invading them. You invade the person. So I think that it's true.
Is there another place where this comes from?
Oh, this is all over in the Talmud. There is this basic notion. It's called Arba Amot. Person's Arba Amot means his private space. Your Arba Amot is your private space. We say, for example, even in the Mishnah, says that every Jew has four cubits in the land of Israel. Right? We have the right to four cubits in the land of Israel. Mm-hmm. Which is to say, you've got even some, because we all have an appropriate place that we will get there, we all need a space. But it's Arba Amot, mm-hmm, it's four cubits. Okay. Very good. We go on. Now, we said just prior to this that because of the structure, father, mother, mother, father, in honor your mother and your father, honor your father and your mother, fear your mother and your father, right? That the effort there is to really equalize them both. It's to go a little bit in the direction that's not natural, given the emotions that tend to be natural toward one or the other of the parents. So it is to establish really both of them at the same level. With that in mind, understand the following story. Sha'al ben almana achat. Fascinating story. And you have to pay attention to the words here. A ben almana, the son of a widow, asked Rabbi Eliezer. Now look what he asks him. Abba Omer Hashkeni Mayim. My father says, give me water to drink. Ve'ima Omered Hashkeni Mayim. And mother says, give me water to drink. Eze Mehem Kode. Which one comes first?
But the father's died.
Okay. He's lying.
He's lying.
I
don't get the point of that whole thing.
Okay. Keep it in mind now. It's a Talmudic story. It's not a Zen story, but it's almost that. Okay? Be sensitive to the subtlety of the language here that this doesn't make sense. All right? A Zen story doesn't make sense. Therefore, it's a true story. Simple stories that make sense are not interesting. This is a story that seems to have something wrong with it. Because it says that he's introduced as a ben almana, as the son of a widow. And instead he asks a question which doesn't make any sense in light of that. But naturally the rabbi doesn't know that. So he's going to give him what seems to be a logical halachic answer. Eze meim kodem, who should come first? Amar le, Rabbi Eliezer said to him, Hanach kavod imcha, leave the honor of your mother, v'aseh kavod avicha, and perform the honor of your father. Namely, the father should come first in this circumstance. Sha'ata v'imcha chayavim b'kvod avicha. Because you and your mother are required to honor your father. Okay? The wife has certain obligations to honor the husband, maybe other concomitant obligations, but there's a similarity between these obligations. Now, as the modern reader, you know, we don't like these separate statuses for men and women, but so it is here. Shatavi imcha chayavim b'chvod avicha. So he gets an answer, and for whatever reason, he's not satisfied. Not satisfied. Why is he not satisfied? Ba lifnei Rabbi Yoshua. So he goes to Rabbi Yoshua.
Shops around.
Goes to Rabbi Yoshua. Amar lo kach. Rabbi Yoshua gives him the same answer. Because it's a reasonable halachic answer. It's a reasonable halachic answer. Amar lo Rabbi. He then says to Rabbi Yoshua, my teacher, nitgar sha mahu. What if my mother was divorced from my father? Okay, now here, this is a good halacha question. The progress of the discussion makes sense. Because, all right, you told me that when my mother is married to my father, my mother will serve my father. That he will ask her to give him something, and she's required to give him something to eat, to drink. Okay? Okay, you said. Now, what is the case where they get divorced? Because both had asked me, she no longer has an obligation to him, and I have an equal obligation to them both. Okay, so. Amar lei. So the rabbi says to him, Mi ben risei enecha nikar sheben almana ata. It's an incredible statement. which is not understood at all by the art scroll here. The art scroll is completely oblivious to what this is. The rabbi says to me, Bein risei einecha. In other words, from between your eyelashes. In other words, I see behind what you are doing that you have no father. That what you are really doing is trying to make a father for yourself. You are really creating a whole series of questions which show to me that you are missing a parent. You are missing a parent. Mibein risei einecha nikar sheben almanata. Hatel lahem mayim b'seifel. Pour water into a pitcher for them. Dekaka lahem ketarnagolin. And coo to them as if they were roosters. In other words, any parent you have, just serve that parent. So you have here, finally, his conclusion is, you know, what you are doing, you are simply, you are asking questions, and I could see from the questions that you are asking that they don't make sense. There's something wrong with your questions. There's a need that you have. And the final conclusion then is different from what we had read before. Final conclusion is you just respect whichever parent you can respect. You know, you have to do what's appropriate. It's a very odd story. Very odd story.
Is he saying that because he didn't accept the answer and went ahead to try and find someone who was going to give him the answer of the mother?
The answer is I don't know. I honestly don't know, and that's why the story is such a wonderful story, because I don't know the answer. It could be... Well, no, that's why, if you read the art scroll comment there, it's absolutely ridiculous, because they can't figure out the eyelash thing, too, and they explain it here. It says here, Rabbi Yeshua, discerning that excessive weeping had thinned out the questioner's eyelashes, concluded that he was an orphan. I mean, that's ridiculous. What it means is, you know, what it means is, I'm seeing through you.
Right.
Or what it means is, you know, even as you speak, I see something, your eyes are shaking, or you know, maybe it's something like that. You're giving yourself away. You don't think that I understand this, but I understand what's going on with you.
I have an unsubstantiated thought about the word resim.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's the iris. I don't know the etymology of the word, but maybe it's the iris, meaning I can see in your eyes, like you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
I can see in your eyes and your look. And
mm-hmm. Maybe. Eyelashes. Maybe.
No, the word
is eyelashes, but iris, it's the pupil.
Iris is the pupil.
But I cannot,
just a thought.
Yeah, we don't know the etymology.
Thyroid, you know, because eyelash tremor is...
Is a thyroid problem?
Thyroid, that's a classic thyroid sign. So I'm wondering if this guy is a little crazy because he's hyperthyroid.
What is it coo like? I don't understand the cooing.
In other words, you should be devoted to your parents.
Oh,
be sweet to your parents.
And I thought maybe it meant that you should give the jug that they can share. In other words, rather
maybe
than
it does. Frankly, I don't know what it means. I really don't know what it means. I'm speculating with a variety of possibilities here, but I think what you're saying it could be. I'm reading it as if it's just using animal imagery to say that you should be of service. You know, that's what it's saying. It could be what you're saying.
I see this reference to the eye as... if someone is sardonic and raises an eyebrow, you know, you could sort of see an expression of insincerity and maybe a little playfulness or sarcasm, and maybe that's what the reaction is to, that sort of a lifting of an eyebrow or something like that.
Could be, yeah, could be.
And there's also a sense, I ask you if you would see this as... You know, if you have one parent, just be nice to them. You know, why ask me these questions? Just be thankful for what you have.
Exactly.
But he doesn't say, give your mother a glass. It says, pour a pitcher for both of them, having already stated that he knows that this questioner only has one living parent.
Well, maybe be respectful of their image and your thoughts about them.
Well, you know, you can still be respectful after the father is gone.
But would you bring your deceased father a pitcher of water?
Well, I'm saying it's a metaphor, about his father's it's a metaphor death. For the reputation of the parent afterwards also.
Oh, but he feels guilty about the father's death.
That's what's so good about stories like this. You know, you begin to speculate, and then we learn as much about ourselves as we do about the reality of the story. That's great. Okay, we go on. Darash Ula Rabba Apitcha de Venesia. Uller, the great, great one, interpreted at the entrance to the house of the Nasi. The Nasi is the head of the Jewish community in Babylonia. My dichtiv, what is the meaning of the verse that's written? Yoducha Hashem kol malchei eretz kisham uim reficha. All the kings of the world will acknowledge you, Hashem, because they heard the statements of your mouth. Ma'mar picha lo nemar. It doesn't say the statement of your mouth, ele imre ficha. Rather, it says the statements, many, of your mouth. Bisha Asha Marakadosh Baruch Hu. When the Holy One, excuse me, blessed be He, said. Now, how do you say Ten Commandments in Hebrew? Etzaret HaDibrot, right. Okay. Or sometimes they're referred to in the rabbinical literature as Mamarot or Mamarim. Okay. They're the ten speeches. The ten speeches. So here reference is made to that. It's not Yoducha Hashem kol malchei eretz kisham u imre ficha. They heard the words, not only the word, but the words of your mouth. Right? When the Holy One, blessed be He, said, Anochi, I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt, commandment number one. And the second one, Lo yihi elecha, you shall have no other gods before me. Amru omot olam, the nations of the world said, Lichvod atzmo hu doresh. God is doing this for His own glory. All right, He starts out saying, "You gotta love me. You gotta do for me." Okay, so the nations listening, they say, "This is some god. He's interested in himself." All right, Amru amot olam. Lichvod atzmo hu doresh. Kevan sha'amar. But when the Ten Commandments came to the verse that said, Kabed et avicha ve'et imecha, honor your father and your mother, chazru v'hodu l'mamarot erishonot. They changed their minds, and they admitted to the wisdom of the first commandments. In other words, when the commandments further down the road, the nations of the world heard, honor your mother and your father, they said, this is a very wise God. And they therefore were willing to accept the first commandments that were said about honoring God. Okay? It's a beautiful way to say it. And the way in which, in fact, the religion could convey its truth was not from the abstract principles of the belief in God, but the belief in God was convincing because of the wisdom of the honoring of parents. But that was the source of it.
I think I'd play it out a little bit more and say, what God would give up or delegate the power that they could arrogate to themselves?
Mm-hmm. This one.
So this one is willing to delegate.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's the delegation that indicates the lack of presumptuousness.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, goes on. Rava Amar. Rava says, same concept. Nehacha. This concept can be derived from the following verse. Rosh Dvarcha Emet. The beginning of your word is true. Rosh Dvarcha Velo Sof Dvarcha. Does that mean that just the beginning is true and the end is not true? Namely, the beginning of the Ten Commandments, the first beginning of the Ten Commandments. Only that's true, Rosh Dvarcha Amet, that's what it says. Ela misof dvarcha nikar sherosh dvarcha emet. But from the what comes in the end, namely, honor your father and your mother, that makes it clear that what is up and up front is true. Okay, that you should honor God. What? Well, that's more or less. More or less. Okay. Bao mine me Rav Ula. They asked Rav Ula. Ad heichan kibud av v'em. Now we're going to get to a series of stories about how far does one have to go to honor one's parent. And these are just fascinating stories. And look at the way in which the story is constructed, very tightly done. So he says, to what extent do you have to go to observe the mitzvah of honoring one's father and mother? Amar lahem, Ula says to them, Tzu'u ura'u me'asa oved kochavim echad be'ashkelon. Go out and see what this pagan who lives in Ashkelon did. A Roman. The Romans are the ones that you have to go look at in order to learn how to honor the father and the mother. Dama ben Netina Shemal. His name was Dama ben Netina. Pa'am echad bikshu chachamim pragmatia. Once the sages wanted to enter into a business deal with him. B'shishim ribo sachar, that we had given him a profit of 600,000 gold dinars. V'haya mafteach munach tachat merashotav shel aviv. And the key to the merchandise was under his father's pillow. V'lo tziro, and he did not want to disturb his father. Incredible story here. I realize, and just in so many ways here, who is the example that the rabbi brings? He brings a Roman example. So that, obviously, as far as the rabbis were concerned, first of all, the impetus to honor one's father and mother is not limited to Jews. It's not limited to Jews. Rather, we saw in the previous story that the nations of the world heard the Ten Commandments. They were doubtful about them, but in fact, when they heard about honoring the father and the mother, they understood that. They understood that perfectly. So obviously, the honor of father and mother, the rabbis of the Talmud themselves realized that it wasn't limited to Jews by any means. To the contrary, they held up the example of the Romans. It's unique. Very few circumstances where you will see this. The Romans are generally not very, very much praised in the Talmud, to say the least. Here, the Romans are praised. Dama ben Netina is the example of the person who reveres his parent. I'll go on a little bit further. Amar Rav Yehuda bar Amar Shmuel. Rav Yehuda said in the name of Shmuel, Shalu at Rabbi Eliezer. They asked Rabbi Eliezer, Adechan kibud av v'em. How far do you have to go with the mitzvah of honoring your father and your mother? Amar lehem, Rabbi Eliezer answered, Similar story. Go and see what this pagan did for his father in Ashkelon. The Dama ben Netina Shemo. And his name was Dama ben Netina. Bigshu mimenu chachamim avanim le'efod. The sages came and wanted to buy from him stones for the ephod of the high priest. Remember, the high priest had to wear an ephod with stones on them. Very valuable stones. Of course, those are the most valuable stones because they were going to go on the garment of the high priest. So they came to purchase it from Dama ben Netina. b'shishim ribo sachar, that would have yielded him a profit of 600,000 gold dinars. So this is a slight redoing of the previous story, which simply tells us why they wanted to engage in a deal with him. Rav Kahana matne bishmonim ribo. And Rav Kahana taught that the potential profit was 800,000 gold dinars. All right, which is, that's a lot of money. That's a tremendous amount of money. But he passed up the deal because he didn't want to disturb his father. The key to the chest was underneath for the precious stones was lying under his father's pillow. Velot Sierra, and he did not want to disturb his father. Lashana ha'acheret. The story goes on. The next year, Natan HaKadosh Baruch Hu Secharo, the Holy One, blessed be He, gave Dama ben Natina his reward. Shenolda lo para aduma be'etro, that a para aduma, a red heifer, was born in his herd. Now, similarly, a red heifer was a very valuable item, because a red heifer was in tremendous demand, because it would be needed only once in a great blue moon, but they would need the red heifer for the purification rites in the temple. Okay? So he had, God rewarded him for his deed of kindness to his father by providing him with a red heifer the next year. Nichnesu Chachmei Yisrael etzlo. The sages of Israel went to buy the red heifer from him. Amar lehem, he said to them, Yodea ani bachem, I know you, she'im ani mevakesh mikem, that if I would ask from you, kol mamon shebaolam, all the money in the world, atem notnim li, you'd give it to me. Ela, because he's of course a Roman, he's not a Jew, says, but I know the ways of you Jews, you know, I know that you're willing to pay anything for a red heifer. Ela ein ani mevakesh mikem ela oto mamon shehifsadeti bishvil kvod abba. However, I ask from you only the amount of money that I lost as a result of honoring my father. Okay. So that was the way that he finally finds a...
It's obliged that he knows that that was the exact transaction.
Excuse me?
It implies that that fellow knew it was the exact transaction.
What do you mean? I don't understand.
He gave up this and now he got this.
Oh, correct.
That's indeed the compensation.
He knew what he lost.
He knew what he lost, he felt that what he gained...
He assumed that came...
To reward him. V'yamar Rabbi Chanina, Uma mi she'enu mitzoveh... Oh, well, let's just take questions till here for a moment. Any comments here? Yes, Mark.
I'm surprised they couldn't find the biblical story with the example.
Why do you think they bring the story of the Romans?
Why do you think?
They do it, we for sure.
You have to be at least as good as the Romans.
Those guys.
Exactly. Roman pagan, who is a Roman, an idolater, a person who engages in all of the most terrible things. If a Roman honors his father and the mother, you, how much more so? Okay, that's the force of it. That's the tremendous force of it.
And not only honors him, but uses an everyday business transaction.
Mm-hmm.
There are different ways of things that you give up. But this is kind of interesting, and I think very powerful.
Right.
Because it's a business transaction. That
yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Why do they say kavod, kaved et avicha, with this Roman and not tirau?
Well, the Romans were good at that. And they're talking about the mitzvah of Kibud Av Va'Em now.
Yeah,
that's for whatever reason.
It's much more powerful to be afraid of his father, not to wake him up in the middle of...
Well, maybe not, but it may be... Oh, I see. You're saying that
we have the two mitzvot.
Right. So at least in this story, I don't think there is a differentiation between the two. Or the language is not very precise. One of the two.
I mean, they're using that the kid was
correct.
Respectful to his father. It could be that he is afraid of his father.
Correct. But here the language is ad hechan kibud av ha'em. Right? So there it is using the language of honor.
Right.
And it is using the Dhamma Bendatina in these stories. So it's not exactly precise. Okay? But I think the point...
Suppy's going to kill him for not making it.
When you wake up, that's the question.
Why didn't you wake me up?
What?
The second I hope he doesn't sleep on heifers. I hope he doesn't put that into his pillow.
Amar Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef says, Meresh hava amina manda hava amarli. At first I used to say that if someone would say to me, Halacha ka Rabbi Yehuda, that the law goes according to Rabbi Yehuda, Diamar suma patur mina mitzvot, avidne yamatavala rabbanan. It's a fascinating statement. Rav Yosef was blind. Keep this in mind. Rav Yosef is blind. So he says here first, at first, I used to say that if somebody would tell me that the law goes according to Rabbi Yehuda, well, what does Rabbi Yehuda say? That a suma, a blind man, is free from the mitzvot. And the question is, a blind man required to observe the mitzvot, you know, all of the mitzvot, as the same as any other man. Okay? So Rabbi Yehuda said that the blind man is free from the mitzvot. So he said, well, since I'm blind, in the old days, I would have thought, avidne yamatavla rabbanan. I would have made a party for the rabbis. In other words, I would have been very happy, because then I can't transgress. Right? I'm saved from punishment if the mitzvot are not applicable to me. I don't have to worry about them. Avidne de yamatavla daha la mifkadina, because I am not commanded by them. I'm not commanded by the mitzvot because I'm blind. Baha avidna, and yet I do perform them. Right? So he's saying that here, if they're not commanded, I'm so happy that I can do them because, you know, it's a greater good to do them without being commanded. Okay? Hashta. Now, however, that I have heard what Rabbi Chanina says, Gadol mitzuvev yoseh yoter mimisha eno mitzuvev yoseh. Greater is he who is commanded and does than the person who is not commanded and does. Adarabba. The opposite now. Have the opposite conclusion. Man diamali de ein alachaka Rabbi Yehuda. The one who says that the law is not according to Rabbi Yehuda, that is to say that the blind man is obligated, avidne yamatavala rabbanan. Now I'm going to make a party for the rabbis. So, several important concepts here. First of all, the concept is gadol mitzuvev yoseh, misha eino mitzuvev yoseh. It is not an intuitive idea for Americans. We assume that it is much better to do something you're not commanded to do than to do something you're commanded to do. If you do it because you're commanded, you have to do it because you're commanded. The view, and you see that this was an argument among the rabbis. The rabbis had different points of view on the matter. But it is clear what the halacha is. The halacha is that it is greater to be commanded and to do it than to not be commanded and do it. And that's a very basic principle in Jewish law, because it is greater to be commanded and do it because the doing of it is in response to the fact that there is a commander. And the ultimate benefit of this is the awareness of the fact that there is a God in the world who has commanded. Okay, that is it. It is not the inner human, the desire to do it. That's worthwhile, but of secondary significance. First significance is that if you're supposed to do it, you do it. And it's also true in terms of if you don't want to do it. It doesn't matter whether you want to honor your father and your mother. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with the fact that there is a God who commands you to do it. That's why you do it. And that's one of the reasons that the honor of father and mother is considered to be one of the, sometimes a very extremely difficult mitzvah. But remember, it's a mitzvah. It's God who wants you to do it. Whether it makes moral sense or not, that's also an issue. But at the bottom line is that it's a mitzvah of God. And it is greater to do that which one is commanded than even to do that which one is not commanded. Okay? I saw a hand somewhere. Yes.
So where is the place of education?
First of all, education, the main purpose of education is to teach you what you're commanded.
Yeah, but you can, if you're teaching to read and write, or just read, in that case, that's all education you need, because you need to follow the mitzvot.
But certainly the first need. It's not necessarily all there is.
Education, I mean, about all the moral society, morals and education of the...
I think it could be argued...
...in the place and the...
I think it could be argued that all of that is in the mitzvot, to begin with. Which is not to say that there isn't place for things beyond that. We're just setting up a hierarchy of that which takes precedence. So the first purpose of the education is Vishinamtam Levanecha, you shall teach them to your children, is so that they know what is commanded. Okay? We're not saying that the education is limited to that, but that's the first thing that has to be done. Yes?
Is the command to honor or revere, okay, your mother and father, not qualified? What if the mother and father are evil?
We'll get to that. It's down the road.
Of course.
Come next week.
Children can't determine if their parents are evil.
No, you wait. You'll see. This is actually an issue. That's why I had the Maimonides open here, too. It's actually a big issue. It's a big issue.
So if I understand the explanation, while it's somewhat counterintuitive, because we might otherwise say, well, if I come up with an idea out of my own volition to do something honorable, rather than being told I'm supposed to do it, isn't that better? However, if God says this is important, that's a higher idea than if I come up with the thought myself.
Exactly. That is correct. Now, I would go further and say that one could reasonably argue that it might be yet a higher ideal to not only do it because God has commanded it, but to do it because God has commanded it, and to do it also because one thinks that what God commands is good and right and worthwhile, and you want to do it. we can move beyond that, you know. We have a certain threshold that we have to start with, but I don't know that has to be the end of things.
Not just because you're told to, but you agree with it.
As we say, the next question that comes in the Halakhic discussions is whether the mitzvot require a kavana. Do you have to have intent when you are fulfilling the mitzvah? Mm-hmm. And the question also is, what does intent mean? Some will argue that the meaning of intent is the intent to fulfill the mitzvah. Some will say that it is to be aware of what you're doing, the significance of what you're doing. That's an issue we've just been studying in the morning minyan. When you recite the Shema, you have to have kavana when you recite the Shema. Well, in that context, I don't think it means that you have to know that God has commanded you to recite the Shema. Maybe that's true, but that's only one piece in it. It is to be aware when you're doing it what you're saying. Saying, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." If you say that without thinking about it, what are you saying? You're not saying anything, in a way. You're just mouthing things that have no meaning. So for some of the mitzvot, in a way, they make no sense unless you have kavanah. Others, for example, giving tzedakah. What if a person gives tzedakah because they want to have a good reputation? It's good for business. Have they given tzedakah? The answer is yes, they have given tzedakah. It's maybe better to give tzedakah without that secondary motivation. But it's much better to give tzedakah than not to give tzedakah. That's a threshold Jewish idea. Henry, you have...
Oh, I just wanted to make sure that Yosef received proper commendation.
Okay.
The reason that he was willing, that he wanted to make the banquet in the first case was not because he was exempt, but he thought that originally if he were exempt, he'd get even greater
correct.
You know, reward. Correct. And then when he found out that he got that
with God,
he'd get more reward if he were commanded, then he would. He was happy to make a banquet because he was so happy to have found that out.
Correct. Yeah. Okay, that's good. Very good. Thank you for the clarification.
We don't want people freelancing too much. I mean, because then everybody's off figuring out what they're going to do that's even greater glory.
Correct.
And reward. That's a very...
Correct.
That's a very dangerous system.
Well, that's not our system. But it's a popular system, frankly. It's what we're living with in the world out there, I think,
right,
to a great extent.
It is problematic a bit, though, when women want to take on this vote that they're not necessarily obligated for, isn't it?
What do you mean by problematic? It's exactly this issue. It's the same thing.
Right. So in other words, it's not so much commended if a woman takes on...
Correct.
She would just get less credit.
Well, but there is no...
She's not making the thing up. She's taking on
correct.
What has been commanded already for men, and she wants to take that on also.
That is not deemed something of great positive significance. That is correct. That is correct. That's why...
Problematic. I think
if that's what you're...
The clash of, you know, how people are instinctively feel about... doing something. I mean, it's an instinctive thing that if you take something on that you know is generally good, that's part of, you know, what people do, and you take it on, then it should be something that is meritorious.
It's a variant of equal pay for equal work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
this is not that.
I think it's a conflict.
Yeah. This is quite different. Yep. No doubt about it. Okay, let's go on. Ki atarav dimi amar. When Rav Dimi came to Babylonia from Eretz Yisrael, remember Rav Dimi was one of the rabbis who traveled. He would study in the land of Israel, and then he would go back to Babylonia, and he would frequently bring the traditions or the teachings of the land of Israel to Babylonia. Amar, he said, Pa'am achat aya lavush sirkon shel zahav. Now, he is... talking about Dama Benatina again. This is our hero here. One time, Dama Benatina was dressed in a gold-embroidered silk coat. Haya Yoshev Ben Gedolei Romi. And he sat among the nobles of Rome. Uvata Imo, and his mother came, Ukraato Mimenu, and she ripped it off him. The tafcha lo al rosho, and she smashed him on the head. The yarka lo befanav, and she spit in his face. The lo hichlima, and he did not shame her. Again, it's an amazing story that Dama ben Netina, and you'll see what's coming up. I don't think we'll get to it tonight, but what's coming up really will allow a certain amount of latitude with the difficult parent, because it's reasonable to say, you know, if you have to experience this, you would be excused for certain actions which would otherwise seem inappropriate. But Dama ben Netina again is used as an example that he took it. He took the abuse. And here he was in public. And that reflects on the Romans. That reflects on the Romans. The Romans really knew how to respect their mothers. And in public especially, you would want to make sure that everybody else saw you respecting your mother properly. That is a basic value of the Romans.
Originally Roman, Dama ben Netina. And I'll just say one.
That he was a good
the name doesn't sound so Roman, and a yellow silk robe that's embroidered doesn't sound like true Roman clothing. It sounds more Eastern.
Well, he was living in Ashkelon.
Oh,
keep that in mind.
He's not wearing a toga. So, I mean, it sounds like an Eastern dress.
They may have all worn togas. I'm not really sure. Keep it in mind as you look at things from the period. It'd be interesting to see what we have from that piece of the world. It's a sculpture or...
Well, I'm thinking Roman in Rome, but they didn't have that. But he's living in Ashkelon. Does the name sound...
Yes, that's okay. Well, like a Roman name? Not necessarily.
He's not called Roman. He says Nohri, which means he's a foreigner.
Eh? No, no. It said it was an Obed Avodah Zarah.
It still doesn't mean it's a Roman.
They were Romans. It's unlikely. And Ashkelon also, if you've been to Ashkelon, I was in Ashkelon a few months ago, and specifically went to look at the Roman sculpture in Ashkelon. It's all been sitting there. They've uncovered it. The archaeological excavations have made it very obvious. It's just amazing. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. So it was a Roman city. Roman city, and the Roman city has been very well, it's a city that goes way back. It was a Canaanite city, a Philistine city, Ashkelon. But the Roman lair is uncovered, and all of the Roman ruins, not all, but plenty of Roman ruins are very obvious there. And you can see even the dress, you can see the pictures of the Roman gods, let's say, on the stelae that are there in Ashkelon. It's fascinating.
This reminds me the story of Joseph, when Jacob goes to see the Pharaoh, and Jacob immediately starts complaining about his life and that he's not as old as his relatives. And so here he is, you know, in the presence of the most important person in that world. And Joseph stays silent, or at least I don't remember Joseph
right.
showing any discomfort, but it's hard to believe that he didn't, mm-hmm. given the nature of this encounter or mm-hmm. Audience.
Right. Right. Well, it wasn't as bad as having your mother spit in your face, you know, and tear your clothes off.
You say there's moderating examples later on, is that what you said?
Yeah, we will get to one particular example where a parent makes it very difficult for a child, and there's a question of how much you have to take, legally how much you have to take. Okay? Yes?
We must remember that the great success of the Roman Empire, which people at that time envied, was that they permitted a lot of autonomy to the countries they ruled.
Mm-hmm. They did permit that autonomy, that's certainly true, but they had a very powerful culture also. It's fascinating to go to these cities where Romans and Jews lived together, mm-hmm. and to see it, the most extraordinary example is in Sippori, where the rabbis of the Talmud lived. Many of the rabbis of the Talmud, we're reading these people who lived in Sippori. You see where the Jews lived in Sippori, and 100 yards away the Romans lived there, and you see they lived just the way you imagine Romans living. And there was a Roman stadium, you know, 50 yards down the road is a Roman stadium, and the rabbis lived here and the Romans lived there. They obviously were very close. They had close relations with each other. They lived in tremendous physical proximity to each other. They had a cultural separation, but they obviously lived in each other's worlds as well. Okay, we go on. Let's see if we can finish up. Oh, let's stop here. It's at 9:30, so we'll cut it here.
Thank you.
To be continued.